understand this fully. There's five important stuff. In the committee, we went through all five. We responded precisely, concisely, and clearly. Said, on your request number one, this is the committee's view, particular majority in the committee. On request number two, this is the committee's view. None of that is mentioned. So I don't think we can pass these reports unless they're sorted out. And I plead with the Secretary to please abide by the decisions taken by the committee or the majority in the committee. So we're going to start with Twin Peaks. Is that correct, Isma?
Yes.
Okay. So, Twin Peaks it is. What's the time of it? It was said yesterday. Oh, yeah. Right. Over to you.
And, you know, thank you, Chair, because even with the previous committee, we were waiting for a long time to be called on Twin Peaks. Every time we see somebody else comes to talk about it to the committee, we're getting a bit jealous and left out. Because we are running it, obviously. And I think we could... No tail peppers, no tail peppers. So we welcome coming here today. And just to say, there's quite a lot of developments on Twin Peaks, but what we're going to do is almost start from scratch today, because we still want to say there's a part two early next year that we want to come back to on Twin Peaks. We're hoping this is the major piece of legislation that will be passed. But Chair, just my team, got Roy Haberman, Kathy Gibson, and Olana Makubela at the back, who sort of deal with the financial sector issues, policy issues in the Treasury. But okay, just to move on. So Chair, I think, you know, when people talk of paradigm shift, the one event in our lifetime that has undoubtedly changed the world is September 2008, when you saw the fate of Lehman and the subprime crisis that was sort of going up, but the big explosion then was with Lehman back in the U.S. when it failed. And that sparked the crisis firstly in the USA. And then slowly the initial crisis, in fact, when Lehman fell, I forget the figure, but overnight the UK, I mean, it was a multinational bank, what we today call a SIFI, and I'll come to that later. But like overnight, before it fell, they transferred $6 billion from the UK to the US. So, you know, when a bank was about to fail, every sort of country is saying, how much money can we keep from this failing bank in this country? So it sparked off a crisis in the UK financial system, in Europe, and even a little bit in Japan. And of course, that led to a recession. And that's the point that members need to know, that a financial crisis is not like a crisis of your telecommunications company or your, you know, a major factory closing down, which clearly involves loss of jobs and hardship. But it actually leads to the crisis hitting other sectors of the economy. And as you saw in South Africa too, what happened was, while our financial sector proved to be sturdy and there weren't any problems with any of our institutions because of the failure of Lehman, and there wasn't any exposure to Lehman or other dominoes that fell because of Lehman. And of course those dominoes didn't fall because in the US you had massive ejections, which started with what, $789 billion package, which was done under President Bush, and then subsequently by President Obama, and of course in QE1, QE2, quantitative easing 3, which has just ended last month or in October. So, and in South Africa, our financial sector wasn't directly exposed, so it survived it well. But of course, in 2009, immediately after, we had our recession, and that led to a loss of 1 million jobs, I remember at the time. And of course, subsequently, we had the Euro crisis 2 years later. And I must say, I think interconnectedness between banks themselves. So In the world today, there are what we call global Sufis, so it's called GE Sufis, and in fact the Financial Stability Board publishes now annually, what is it, about 20 of the big institutions. And what happens to them is that they have much higher capital requirements, they have much more intrusive supervision done on them. Of course, it has all the usual players, Bank of America, Citibank, Goldman and Sachs, etc., Deutsche Bank. But for South Africa, I think what's important is that Barclays is one of the global cities. And yeah, it's important to just note that, because if you then look at a bank like EFSA, for example, its home regulator is in the UK, so it's the Bank of England. They are the primary regulator. The regulators in South Africa are called host regulators, not home regulators. So a lot of, and the regulators then have what they call supervisory colleges. And these things didn't work as well as they should have. Immediately after 2008, it was recognized that just like for Lehman, you needed a supervisory college of the US regulators, the UK regulators, the European regulators, everywhere where it bank was significant, you needed the local regulator. So that's a big issue just to keep in mind, how global SUFI gets regulated. But having, so what FSB then did was it focused quite a lot on getting higher standards. The one you will have heard of is Basel III, for example. On the insurance side, there's also moves to set up higher capital standards and liquidity standards. And to give you a sense of the FSB, so who does it bring together? The banking standards are determined by the Basel Committee of Banking Supervision. Now, in insurance, we have a similar body called the IAIS, International Association of Insurance Supervisors, something like that. And then you have IOSCO, which deals with securities. All these three bodies are independent, but they come to the FSB together with the G20 countries, and that's a place where they try and coordinate standards to extend that they need coordination. So having set the higher standards that lays the basis for dealing with the too big to fail problem, the FSB now is moving towards addressing new and, as I say, constantly evolving risk vulnerability. Because the thing with the financial sector is you can supervise your banks more harshly, but then you have the problem of shadow banks, and these are things that the institutions that sound like a bank, crack like a bank, have their wings like a bank, but they're not regulated as a bank. So what happens is that there's a looser regime, and the vulnerability then shifts to these types of funds. And the G20 leaders have generally supported this approach, and in the last visit meeting, to now shift and ensure that the system is based on mutual trust and cooperation. And just to give you a sense of that, what regulators tend to do is, it's quite important here that you hold our supervisors here to account, in the sense that they need to act, and to act without your favor. If they don't act, what tends to happen is the other regulators then don't place reliance on our regulators. That opens up our firms to being fined. So to give an example, the FCA fines Standard Bank, fines just on money laundering standards. Okay? Because although money laundering is not covered here, but the same principle applies. That if your standards are not seen to be of their standard, they're going to fine our institutions, because our institutions in some way or the other are going to operate in those jurisdictions. You need access to dollars, you need access to funding. Our companies, our banks do have to operate. There's no way you can not be part of the global economy. And it's very important that our supervisors are seen to be strong. And what they have between regulators is what they call a fast porting system. But once they place reliance on your system, they then recognize the companies that operate that overseas, because they know that your standards are high. So any supervisor in South Africa that doesn't meet with international standards, it will actually expose our financial companies to all kinds of fines. In fact, currently we're quite worried that the FCA has also put South Africa on a watch list, and we want to actually contact them and ask them what will system of mutual trust and cooperation between regulators is quite a critical area in the financial sector today. So, Chair, if you look at the work that's been done with the G20, once standards are agreed, and if you look at the grey block, I mean, you'll see that we've also dealt with, sorry, before you get to the grey block, on the earlier slide, I can't read that, but Roy has said in your earlier slide, you dealt with the earlier work, which is the work on tweak to fail the check, but also on OTC derivatives. Watch out to shadow banking and mutual assessments. And mutual assessments are quite important to note here. So what happens is, in today's world, the IMF, in addition to Article 4, where they come every year to assess your economy, certain financial policies and so on. In addition, once every 5 years, the IMF conducts quite a rigorous FSEP, Financial Sector Assessment Program. And these programs sort of look at vulnerabilities of your financial system. They look at whether your banking sector meets the Basel standards, your regulators and your institutions. They do some stress tests. They look at your insurance standards. They look at your security standards. So they look at the ASE, they look at the FSB, etc., to the extent that they play a role in the system. And they make a whole host of recommendations, which then say, we think your banking standards and your legislation, your bank act is weak in these three respects. You need to address that by legislation. Or practice of your regulators is not inclusive enough. Now, South Africa did an FSEP in 2010, okay, which was still an old-style FSEP. So the IMF wanted to, although they did every 5 years, they did an FSEP on South Africa this year, and their report is expected to be out shortly. In fact, it's before the IMF board, and it's a matter that the IMF will normally publish these reports after October 2000. So sometime in December, when you get your Article 4 comes out, this year you will get an asset. It will assess the South African financial sector. And what happens is the G20 through the Financial Stability Board, every 2.5 years, they check to what extent has your country met the standards or the recommendations of the SF. And we had one done last year, 2013. As I said, the IMF accelerated the FSEP because of some issues that they raised, and the issues that they raised in our system, and it's this document that you have, the peer review report, which look at our financial system. It's not as comprehensive as the FSEP, but the key negatives that they looked at in our system is that our coordination mechanisms between regulators is not as good as it should be. In fact, they say it's quite poor, and they felt that we needed to take further steps on OTC derivatives reforms. Over the counter derivatives. Now, Chair, I think that all these are very complex and so issues which, I've been done through a workshop to explain these things, but just to show you the jargon that's been done on the South African system, and we have to then make sure that in responding to twin peaks, which I'm now coming to, that we respond to these weaknesses. And I should add that while South Africa was ahead of the curve in 2010 in terms of the quality of our supervision, we need to just take note that other countries have moved on and have improved their laws. So to give you an example, in 2008, they didn't regulate credit. We were ahead of the curve, we regulated credit, we had the National Credit Act, and we had the National Credit Regulator. Now for all countries, or many countries have it, the UK has done it, the US has done it, and they generally have now, in a sense, overtaken South Africa. So if you look at it in the UK, they've taken action to virtually almost close down payday lenders, okay, like Walmart.com. I can mention them South Africa is not, you know, we need to not be complacent that we survived in 2008. This is an extremely dynamic sector. There's lots of scope for regulated arbitrage, and to the extent that we're not changing our rules or improving the quality of our supervision, we will get left behind. So, as South Africa, I think the way so these are all the, and I've dealt with all of these issues, okay? And Chair, if you look at the papers, if members are interested, I mean, if you go into the Financial Stability Board's website, you see lots and lots of papers that they have, including on supervisory intensity, the meetings that they have with boards, financial institutions, etc. And you hope that our regulators, in fact, read those reports, because it's a huge number of reports to read, and that they don't sort of sit in a silo, which is the dirty secret of the financial crises, that regulators actually don't talk to each other, even if they have MOUs. The MOUs are not worth the paper they are written on, as you saw in the UK. And you actually need much more compulsory forms of coordination also, and to deal with the structural issues that ensure that there's a more effective sharing of information. So that's all about the international. With regard to South Africa, we looked at the crisis because we were affected in 2008. We could take our time to respond. So Chair, we produced this book, the so-called Red Book, A Shape of Financial Sector to Serve South Africa Better. And this document was sort of, you know, Cabinet endorsed it, and in fact, it laid the basis for saying, in South Africa, these were our list. We felt, for example, that if you look at the prudential side, whilst the quality of our banking supervision was good, we also needed to improve it in insurance, in securities, etc. And that's why we decided that we needed one prudential regulator. But importantly, we also recognized that you know, the blood of a central banker is not good, a prudential regulator, to look at bad practices, high bank fees, or bad practices by selling of products, etc. And therefore we set up what's called one market conduct regulator. I'm sure it's in one of the slides I'll come to that. But the other important thing to recognize is to formalize that the South African Reserve Bank will be responsible for overseeing financial stability. And this, I think, is very important, especially in the light of African banks. You saw this, the failure there. That you need to make sure that when an institution fails, a financial institution, a bank state, that it doesn't infect the entire system. And that financial stability framework is now being upgraded to be quite an important objective for the central bank to do in a framework that's being done. Move on. So Chair, we then, through this document, there were a whole lot of principles which the cabinet sort of endorsed, including saying that, you know, if you take the first principle, that financial service providers, you can't operate and sell a financial product or service by yourself. You've got to be licensed and effectively regulated. You've got to check that they meet fit and proper standards. So there's a number of principles. I won't go through them because I find it hard to read. Do you want to talk through that quickly?
I'll just highlight the most important ones at the moment, is highlighting financial service providers are appropriately licensed and regulated. Principle 5 is very important, that regulators can operate objectively with integrity and be relatively independent from outside influence, both from political influence and particularly from influence from the people that are regulated. And then there are issues in terms of Principle 10, which around systemically important financial institutions, which are also very important. Given the risks that they pose to domestic systems and to other systems. And then principle 15, which is that we need to ensure that our system is benchmarked to the rest of the world, so we need to ensure that everything is appropriate with international standards.
Okay, the focus then, as I said, was on three areas. Roy, you want to still talk to this? Once you do that.
Okay. So we have a three-pronged approach to implementing in affairs of financial sector to serve South Africa better. The first question which we try to deal with is who regulates the financial services sectors. The second question is how do we regulate the specific risks? And the third, those prudential risks are those are the risks that a financial services institution will collapse and bring more problems with it. And then the third component is how do we regulate how financial services institutions behave with respect to their clients. So what do they tell their clients when they sell products? How do they sell those products, etc.? And I guess with all the legislation that we brought to this committee in the last 5 years, I think many of us have spent long hours with us in some of the legislation, but essentially there's been a long, since 2011, a long process of updating and reforming most of our legislation in these three areas. But particularly now what we're doing is sort of the last piece in the puzzle, which is the first question, which is who regulates and how do they regulate? So the SWIFT different piece is really an answer of who regulates the financial services sector and how are regulators set up to do that responsibility.
So Chair, just to move on, just to go back before we all focus on legislation. So the big issue is the SARB doing financial stability. But the SARB then also be responsible under Twin Peaks for prudential regulation. Now prudential just looks at, a prudential regulator looks at whether an institution is sound, financially sound, whether the bank is going to be able to deliver on its promises. If depositors want the money that they get on time, if pensioners want to retire, expect to be paid, that they are paid, that the money is actually there. That's a prudential issue, and they are like doctors. If there's a problem, their job is to fix up the problem. Okay. The market conduct regulators, and we've got slides later, but the market conduct, I think we're quite excited about it, because in Sorrento we do believe that we've not vetted strongly enough for financial customers. If we want to hold the financial sector to higher standards than generic legislation on consumer protection, and this is a practice all over the world, because it's not as easy as selling a vacuum machine and then you see it doesn't work, you come back. If, as you know, on your pension fund, you may only find out 40 years later that you save for 30 years, you might get paid out for the first 20 years, but 20 years left, but then the fund goes bust because somebody stole the money. Or, more importantly, because someone has been sophisticated enough to charge you high fees without telling you, and like you see on our retirement slide, that up to half your growth can be taken away by a simple 3% per annum admin fee, risk fee, you know. The financial sector has lots of layered fees, and they're very good at that, at making money, but for themselves, and not in the interest of the customer. The other sort of problems you have is that people are sold inappropriate products. You buy car insurance, you find there's 50 different products. You don't know whether it covers you for hail. It just makes it impossible for the customer. And so there's now, or let's take the payday lenders, okay? Walmart.com and others, payday lenders in South Africa. Well, these guys need to be regulated very harshly. In fact, we need to ask whether we even want some of these institutions in South Africa. You'll find that they just get registered easily. And over the internet, loans are paid. And that drives you people into indebtedness, which is a huge crisis, I think, that we have in South Africa. So we say that our market conduct regulators need firstly to have tough legislation, but we also believe that within the current legislation, they've not been tough enough so that you prevent problems and not act reactively when you see the problem. So this is quite an important area that we think in South Africa has been quite neglected, and that's why we're in a hurry for Twin Peaks, because we feel that this is quite an important priority to put on the table. Move on. So we don't have to do this, but just so the big issue with Twin Peaks is effectively there's a financial sector regulation building score that establishes it formally. The government last year approved in last December, approved the first draft. We also will be coming to you generally every year, like we have the tax laws amendment bills. We think we should have a financial services launch general amendment bill every year, because what happened is there's 11 acts of parliament.
11, how many, Kathy?
Okay. And every year something needs to change. You've got to just do it on a cross-cutting basis, like the way you deal with the tax laws, because otherwise you wait 5 years and the financial sector moves with the speed of light, so there's just no way we can wait on that. There's a bill that we do want to bring urgently to Parliament called the Bank Amendment Bill, which does require some strengthening on the resolution powers, and we need to deal with current problem that we have. Move on. Okay. So, Chair, I think I'll skip through some of these slides, which is just for you before. I think we can have lots of arguments to show why the financial sector is different, why it needs to be dealt with more strictly. And you know, you get lots of people writing articles knocking us, you change the law of contracts, etc., etc. So you get it from the free market foundation type approach. I don't know what planet some of them are living on, but if you go to the US, you go to the UK, you go to a big capitalist country, they have pretty interventionist approaches to the financial sector, to the point that you recognize that this is a powerful sector, and therefore there's an asymmetry of power. When customers have a complaint, that's why you have an ombuds system, because you can't wait to fight the pension fund for 20 years after you retire. You won't have the resources, and if you ever do it, you may be dead before you enjoy the fruits of any of dealing with any abuse. So generally in the world, there's pretty tough approaches that are taken. And to the extent that if we feel that an insurance contract is unfair, so let me give you an example. We all have motor car insurance, we've got cars, right? But the companies were not adjusting, you know, it's a depreciating asset, but they won't change the value of the car that's insured unless you form them at the beginning of the year. Now, we push the insurance industry to say you need to deal with that, because, and this is the important point, and I'm going to ask Kathy to talk about it. There's a big campaign that the FSB has launched, and underlying market conduct is a treat customers fairly approach. And I don't know if Kathy, you want to share some things about your business line as well.
So I think Moma had already highlighted the importance of not only an emphasis on the way in which financial institutions conduct their business, but also the way in which the regulatory environment itself is shaped, the way in which supervision happens. And what Treating Customers Fairly initiates is a cross-cutting approach to dealing with market conduct issues in the financial sector. So what we have up until, or what we have had, is a series of regulatory interventions that we actually try and deal with problems as they've escalated. The problem with that approach is that by that stage, we already have consumers who are suffering extensively. Another problem with that approach is that it takes the position that across the various subsects in the financial sector, that things all happening differently, whether talking about banks or insurance or collective investment schemes, that somehow these industries operate totally in silos. And so we then respond on an ad hoc basis to disclosure issues in the insurance sector, for example. However, the lesson this moment has already alluded to is that the financial sector operates as a system, which in effect means that in order to deal comprehensively with conduct abuses, you need to acknowledge that system and deal with it on a cross-cutting basis. So where you've got problems with disclosure, don't just deal with disclosure on the insurance policies, deal with the disclosure on insurance policies and banking policies and collective investment schemes in a similar way to make sure that we don't create gaps in space for regulatory arbitrage. So what the Treating Customers Fairly Initiative has started is to look at the system as a whole, as the financial sector as a whole, start introducing standards for the sector as a whole that deal not only with taking a reactive view, but are forward-looking. How do you want the sector to behave? And start interacting, start its preemptive approach to regulation supervision, and start engaging with the financial institution saying, what outcomes should the sector be delivering on? What outcomes should you as a financial institution be delivering on? And are you actually meeting those outcomes? Do your customers understand what products they're buying? Do they understand the risk of those products? And what that also means is it's introducing a fairly judgment-based approach to supervision as well. It's no longer just an approach of, well, that's the rule, stick to the rule, and if you're not sticking to the rule, then the customer must be okay. Actually, no, that's a minimum standard. The fact that we require you to disclose does not mean that the customer needs to hear and understand the product that they're getting, even if you've given them a piece of paper which explains it. Your product must be designed in a way which benefits the customer. It must meet the customer's needs. You must explain that product in a way which the customer understands and be able to show to the supervisor that you've managed to satisfy these various outcomes. I'm going to some point to explain that this really does lay the basis for the change in approach to conduct supervision, which will, the GCM is laying the basis for the new conduct framework, which we'll be following.
Financial regulators are like doctors. Market conduct regulators are more like police or lawyers, okay? That they look for the bad products and try and take it out of the system. They impose fines, as you've seen how overseas banks being fined, whether it's libel rigging, whether it's foreign exchange abuses, you've seen massive fines against your major banks. These are the practices that the market conduct regulator needs to do. And if you look at our Twin Peaks, and by the way, not because we copied them, we haven't, but in 2011, the UK at about the same time, I think a month after us, decided to have the same Twin Peaks system. Because the logic up to 2008 was to have one supervisor and they had the FSA, which was outside the Bank of England, and that caused the problem. Okay. But, and that's why they moved their prudential regulator into the Bank of England. We're doing the same. Our prudential regulator will be in the Reserve Bank. And then they converted their FSA into the FCA now, which is a market conduct regulator. It does a little bit of prudential as well for the non-significant ones. For non-significant ones, for low-risk prudential financial sector bits. And we too are then aiming to transform the FSB into a new market conduct regulator. So, yeah.
And this is internationally, and it's like this analogy of like the doctor and the doctor and the manager, and I think that's in line.
Sorry.
Okay. Sorry. My apologies, I just wanted to make the point that I think the conduct as well as prudential, that we need to increasingly be preventive. We need to be monitoring those conduct risks and the patient steps before they can actually escalate into a crime.
If the director is sick, then the chief director or like they feel, you know, like awkward to say anything because the CEO has spoken. So what would happen sometimes, you go to have tea and then a chief director would sit by you and say, well, actually, it's not the high position sometimes, so why don't you raise it? So the committees that I chair, I always say, I don't care whether you are, you know, the lowest level of the hierarchy of the highest, this is the forum for engagement, and you must give the MPs the best input you can. Now, I know that he would have cut you off, so we're on the same page. You can, it's not our business how you conduct yourself, but you can just pass it if you add in and so on. So feel free. I don't know how long I'll be the chair here, but provided I'm here, this is the way you're going to work. There's no rule that prevents that.
I assure you, in the treasury, we don't have a shouted thing. Okay, but so let's end up and then we can open up the discussion. So anyway, we're just giving you a sense of overseas where this is done. So South Africa, you do have different models of a single regulator cell and a twin peak. So we're not painting twin peaks as a panacea, okay? At the end of the day, it's about how good the people are in whatever system you have, okay, and whether they act when they should act. But we think in South Africa, it really started with a jolly panel into banking fees when we realized that actually, if you're a financial regulator, you know, you don't mind if fees are high because that means that the institution is more profitable and it's sound. Whereas if you market conduct, you're going to focus on lower fees. So, you know, there is a tension that you have. And we think it's good to have two separate regulators with two different objectives. But what Twin Peaks does is it compels them to work together in some structured way. Move on. So this is just the usual diagram we've been floating around of prudential authority, the market conduct authority. But underlying it, there's financial stability, I've talked about the SARB, and there's also stellar enforcement mechanisms on the tribunal and so on. Now, this is over and above what should be happening in the criminal justice system. And I should add that this is another, this area works, but you do need in the criminal justice system to improve our capacity to prosecute people who commit fraud in the financial sector. This is an area that is a problem, that people do get away with murder. And I think if you just move on. So, Chad, I think the message I want to leave you with is in the financial sector, if you have too many systems, you have too many regulators, there's a huge scope for regulatory arbitrage and problem shopping. And your financial sector, and it may not be just the big players, it's really the small players who know how it moves like water, you know the gaps. And that's why what we're moving towards the uniform system of licensing any financial institution. And you get a license. The license can be withdrawn or you can change it under curatorship if they don't meet standards. The supervision that needs to be one system. Enforcement, one system. When customers complain, in the first instance, you want the company to be able to deal with it satisfactorily. You need to publish how they deal with complaints. If they don't deal with it, then it goes to ombuds. How can you improve the system of ombuds? Then people appeal against these decisions. How do you deal with those? Then there's the issue of consumer education and advice. How do you deal with all those issues in a more systematic way? You know, some of the most educated people fall for, if you look at the Tenenbaum scam, you had CEOs of major institutions that fall for it because it doesn't matter how much education you have. Greed can make you blind to all your education. And so you need to look at who do you need to protect, how paternalistic should the state be. We are talking of the retail mass market where we think the market conduct operator needs to be effective. So the process going forward, I mean, we've just given you the first outline. In a sense, we could also have made this presentation 2 years ago almost, because this was what Cabinet had approved. And as I said, Cabinet did approve the first version of the bill last December. We received over 300 pages of comments. There's been substantial engagement. But look, substantial as it is, you know, let's take the Joburg JSE. A lot of the people are affected, so obviously they are not in the center of these consultations, but they might be consulted on bills that affect them. They may not be dealing with banking, for example, so they're not going to get consulted. But we intensify the consultation now with the second draft, okay? Because initially we just focus on getting their written comments and having perhaps a few bilateral meetings. But now we're hoping to publish the second draft of the bill, I'm hoping in the next month. And then once you take a quick round of second comments, have an intensive period of consultation, and then hopefully table the bill sometime in May next year. And I'm hoping that the committee will be able to prioritize this bill, because we do need to get the system going. And it's not to say nothing's happening in the meanwhile. All our regulators are already, like with the three customers ready initiative, it's already happening. But the point is that we do need some of the tougher laws that underpin that approach and we're hoping that that could be then implemented early in 2016, hopefully if the law is passed. So thank you, Chair. Chair, I should just say on the documents, so we've given you, we don't have copies, but I'll give you, Chair, the original copy. But we made both copies. That was our response document. Then you also, so for most members, it's in this form. And just the committee, we've had a joint process with the SAR and the FSB, and between former Deputy Governor Paniyako, Dube Shidi, and myself, to chair the process and have a committee to process the bills, comments, the sheet, and to develop the bills. So what we did was, after that document, this document implementing the Twin Peaks model was published early in February, February last year. That guided the bill. And this was comments made when the bill came out. I wouldn't advise that you rush to read the bill, the first version, because wait for the second draft version, which will come out shortly, hopefully, inshallah, that you can look at that. And then what I would advise you is that you also look at the peer review done in 2013 by the FSB, and then certainly at the end of this month, there will be an FSAP assessment, which I would definitely recommend, and I would suggest here that we come to Parliament to talk about the FSAP, because that is an independent assessment of our system, and it shows the vulnerabilities that you have. And I'm going to make sure that before the end of the day, we just give you one more document, which is the letter to the G20 leaders, which sums up the work of the FSB, which I think is good reading here for members who are interested. So thank you, Chair.
Contribution, questions, whatever? David, Dave? Whatever. David, you can turn up.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, we agree that the financial services sector should be regulated, and the government must intervene appropriately. Of course, the challenges to regulate are not over-regulate, and to a certain extent, that's high for the industry. I have specific questions that I can perhaps read out to you. Many people are concerned about the analysis in terms of proper cost, as was done in the introduction of the FIRES institution, and also with regards to, we know only two countries in the world that describe this particular format as a pilot basis. That was the submission that we received, both with dubious results so far, Australia and the UK, and no one else. Do you think still think this is appropriate for us? And then why are the credit, national credit, NCR, the National Credit Regulator, and credit grants not included in the Twin Peaks, or are they included in the money? Are they still going to work on a separate basis? And then if I can speak to my notes also, I would just like to make a few comments. The more intrusive approach, I think it is necessary there through you, because if we see what's happened in the Ponzi schemes, especially with regards to property syndicates, well, the Twin Peaks also address that. And I think you've quite correctly made the point of regards to the criminal justice system failing us. We have to find somehow a way that people lose their money, and ultimately there's bad side of the consequences that we need for those people initiated the scheme. They do get away with both of that. So this one, I'm not sure. People lose a lot of money. We know about the 52,000 lost money in share. It's still somehow dubious what happened to those, to the money, and whether those pensioners are mostly were involved in property investments, whether there was any results from it. That is a huge concern to me. And then lastly, with regards to the role of the South African Reserve Bank as a prudential regulator. We've seen to the issue of African Bank and the timing of the intervention. Any analysts indicate that this was entirely avoidable 2 years ago, and to a certain extent, there was minimum intervention from South Africa. From the South African Reserve Bank. In terms of their comfort in this Twin Peaks, sort of check it out, because they were in a position to do, as you said, the custodian of financial stability, which was not done, and your views specifically on African Bank, the intervention from the Reserve Bank. In terms of the Ponzi schemes, can I just make this analysis? My personal view is, in terms of the Ponzi schemes, the interventions was too early, perhaps because in a building operation, it takes a lot of time to complete it. Many of the interventions came when the and there was a close priority in terms of completing the building. So the intervention event was premature, in my opinion. But in Africa Bank, I think it was very late in terms of the intervention. And really, with regards to South Africa Reserve Bank, I still think it was a very in-depth analysis. And the consequence of the bank not intervening for pension funds and for taxpayers has also should be noted.
Thank you. Let me start by welcoming your presentation. Mine is just one issue. I want to check how does a shadow being manifest itself in the South African situation. I'm asking this just to appreciate how shadow being is the government in our country. Thank you.
Ask two questions. One is, obviously, all of us have asked owners of what happened in some form or another in September 2008, right? Subjectively, my understanding is from within a particular ideological perspective. But this is a different form. In a nutshell, as you've simply explained what you're seeking to do, how did national electricity even happen in September 2008? What exactly happened? The human brother. And in a nutshell form, the way you would explain to somebody very new to today, what are the key lessons? We need to know to what extent, your legislation is based on the implications, the events of 2008 you're addressing. So we need to know how do you see what happened. Simple four or five reasons why it happened. Right? Why South Africa needs you to explain it, because I was the only question that you explained that we're ahead in 2010, but since then we've fallen behind. Now, from what I understand, the UK has a similar twin peaks model, but you also mentioned Germany. Has Germany always had this model? And if so, that might be why it may have managed the crisis better. You talk of high capital and liquidity standards. What do you mean by this, and what are the standards? I'm not very clear when you talk about both stimulations, what you were saying, because it implies sometimes almost explicit critique or criticism of the role of both stimulations. Is that the case? Explain a bit more. And is that directly anywhere in the bubble that you have in mind? Just a matter of interest, why were you so ahead? I know I was really impressed and proud, see. I read somewhere that even the United States politicians came here to look at our credit regulation. It was an article in Business Times or whatever some years ago. It was certainly some of the countries in the EU were so impressed with our credit regulation that they came to look at us in our model. Why were we ahead of the rest of the world? Was it because we were concerned that what was going on in our country was the 1994 transition, where people had been willy-nilly and were actually having a crisis surfacing with low savings and so on. What, in short, were the reasons why we were ahead in respect of the need of credit regulation? Well, Channel 90 was that. He asked how it's spread. I don't know what it is. I thought your definition of market and prudential is very nice. Very simple, very clear. Obviously, there are overlaps, right? I like this idea of a free entry of legislation and also, nice term, I've never heard this before, it's a judgmental approach to legislation. The other thing I'd caution against is you're getting a defender. You don't like that. They see something sinister in government, even though I don't think they're doing anything sinister in their mind. So if you are getting in December, take into account it's a dead 3 weeks from mid-December till, well, for most of our 8th of January. Dead is one thing to you. That was joking. I can't do this to you. It's very boring to you, but I mean, you know. Now the thing is, I think you just said that you should give people enough time. Okay. Finally, I'm a bit surprised actually, given the ramifications of this legislation, how contested it's going to be. But you only got 300 pages of them. I think there's going to be missing them. Why so little? Because I'm late. Take the property rates bill in 2004. Well, 3,800 pages of arriving in the record. Over a 6 month period. Of comments. So I'm really surprised. I think many people of you haven't expressed it yet. Or is it that somehow they've been engaging with you so many years that it means that you only get 300 pages of comments? You know, in a way, what have we always say, well, at least I belong to that tradition in the ANC that said this. I don't know whether it's the majority of you. But it's a credible one, which is that the executive should come to Parliament with legislation that, you know, especially when it's highly contested, appropriately processed. So we don't find a situation, as we've done it both in the committee that I chair, where people come to you, they make all sorts of representations, you go through a normal process and go on, and then when they come to Parliament, 80% of what they actually said to you, Parliament accepted. So one is likely wary of the 300, but hey, maybe a measure of your success. It's doing some degree of consensus. I'm just very surprised it's 300 pages. Okay, I'm done.
Thanks, Chair. I'll get the team here to come in and answer the hard questions. But let me just share a few comments. I think Kathy can maybe just deal with it. Toothpicks, I mean, among the countries that survived the crisis quite well were countries like Australia, Canada, Sweden, etc. Australia and Canada have a toothpick system. In fact, often with even less involvement from the central banks. We've been careful to say it doesn't matter what system you have, because you can, Sweden has a more unified system, right? It really depends on the culture of the regulators and how they approach the provision and how they share information and so on. Because I can tell you, even in our case, you can have the same organization. And I think it's not as a criticism. If you take our own case, like the financial services board, you've got someone responsible for insurance, someone for collective investment schemes. We say to have you guys talk together. So it's not just about whether it's one organization or not. It's about how you break cycles, how you organize, how cross-cutting is your approach. Our approach also tends to be, you know, we've got a bank check, insurance, two insurance checks, etc. Down the line, we want to not focus only on specific activities, but let it be more cross-cutting legislation. So I think, Honorable Ross, the type of system has less to do with success. But I think in South Africa, what we're saying is market conduct is actually being quite neglected. And financial customers are actually treated quite badly. And it's not in the culture of our prudential regulators to focus on market conduct. So it's a typical situation where if a prudential regulator has prudential objective and a market conduct objective, not only do they, which sometimes even conflict, we don't really go through both well. In fact, in the UK, they focus a lot on market conduct and forgot the prudential, which led to them bailing out a lot of their institutions. But certainly, I don't think the system, I think it's the culture and how good your regulators are, whether they are operationally independent, how do you take financial stability to account, etc. But having said that, I do think that we are moving along the lines that many countries have begun to move. Let me but you want to just get on to answer the other issues. Let's start with the global financial crisis before we come to Honorable Ross's specific issues. And on NCR, that's what I'll deal with. But let's deal with the reasons for the 2008 crisis, the way we analyze it, shadow banks and home post regulators.
Yeah, I'll start with the 2008 crisis. Jay, it's a very big question, and there's a lot of complex reasons. In the Dutch books, we set out our 2011 analysis on page 9 of the Red Book. We set out sort of a high-level summary of what we thought happened in the crisis. And that's what we just gave you, that one of it. Yeah, so chapter 2 goes into quite a lot of detail about the crisis. Yeah, the first couple of members of crisis. Yes. To help everyone, we have a website called www.treasury.gov.za/twinpeaks where everything related to Twin Peaks is accumulated. Some of the files are quite big, so it's quite difficult for people to find. So we keep it all there. Essentially, there's a combination of factors. One of the big factors is that China was a huge sort of restructured so to make it easier for banks to access more money. What they did is they securitized a lot of their loans, which means they packaged them into sort of securitized instruments, and they then sold that to other parts of the financial system. So typically a bank would take a loan, a whole set of loans, and it would sell it to a pension fund, for example. So it would take a loan and then get cash back for the pension fund, from the pension fund. Essentially that left its balance sheet. So the ultimate outcome was that the bank had more capacity to lend even more, so it just kept on lending. So these pension funds and other financial institutions got stuck with these securitized instruments, and they have all these cool names like T's loans. So these stuff that was securitized were very dodgy things. And then they started collapsing because it turned out that they had these things like mint loans, which are income notes, loans which are basically they were lending people money to buy houses, even though they didn't have any income or any jobs. So these loans all went bad in these securitized instruments, and the effect of that was really to cause a lot of distress in not in the banking system necessarily, but in the non-banking system. So pension funds, institutional investors, etc. And often these securitized instruments were actually bought by funds outside of the US. So famously both German, small German banks bought those securitized instruments. And so in the end, this problem sort of propagated itself around the world. And just had a rolling effect, particularly when Lehman Brothers, which was one of the big banks that arranged many of these things, collapsed. It wasn't able to service its debts more. We realized this was a big house of cards.
But these were also often AAA assets, so others would buy to hold as part of your reserves, etc.
So we've done, I'm just going back to the legislation side. Some of the legislation that we brought to the committee has tried to do many pieces of this. So the Financial Markets Act, for example, deals with the creation of derivatives, so over-the-counter derivatives, many of which are the securitized instruments or have been packaged by securitized instruments and derivatives generally. Those are dealt with in the new Financial Markets Act, which brought to the committee in 2012. Some of the highlights of the AAA problems, the credit rating agency didn't necessarily rate things appropriately, so there's a huge financial process to ensure globally that there's a proper system, so we brought through our own piece of legislation to fit in credit rating business act, then the Banks Amendment Act, a lot of things to ensure that the banks were stronger. So the Banks Amendment Act, for example, implemented Basel 3, which is much stricter rules for how you're allowed to hold certain types of instruments.
Your question on what was the underlying cause is a difficult one, as Roy has said. The subprime loans were just a trigger, because there was a problem. It was just a final trigger. I don't think that by itself created the problem. The problem is probably much more deep-seated. We needed to look at all the interconnectedness, and you just need a small problem then to explode and become a huge problem. And that's why today, when they look at it, they're looking at what's the quality of loans that a bank has. You get banks to write off loans. So if you look at an African bank, you know, was your provisioning system too optimistic? Famously, Morgan's, when they suddenly changed the provisioning again, I mean, the same outcome went through the roof. Well, fraud, okay? So, you know, in the jargon, you'd have things like banks would pretend and extend. It's a bad loan, they just restructure it and pretend it's a new loan. So the book is bad. And once somebody pops the bubble, something happens. Now, what's the underlying reason? I mean, it could be, even if you look at it in South Africa, we wanted to get credit to the poor. The moment you start giving too much credit and to people who can't afford it or pay back, and these are all AAA rated, and suddenly, you know, the fact comes, you know, people realize actually the system is not based on anything real. So one can have various theories underlying that as well. But the specific measures, like the derivatives and the interconnectedness, were things that were not seen. Dealing with too big to fail, etc. The exposures, the vulnerabilities. So that's why you need
quite a risk-based approach. And, you know, nobody can actually see all the risks. And the cleverest people actually can see the risk. So I don't think we can go into the reasons. I think what we give you is just one side of it, our reading. But there are lessons just in terms of the financial sector, which has been sort of taken into account. And I think that the bigger issue is, and something's known in South Africa, if you look at the Red Book, something that I didn't share earlier, we don't just look at financial safety and look at market conduct. We also say integrity of the system is important, money laundering, etc. Because if our banks don't act, as I said, they can get fined. If you look at BNP Paribas, they got fined just under $9 billion. You don't ever want that to happen to our power banks. It could make our entire country go bust if one overseas regulator would impose a fine like that on any of our banks. And of course, financial inclusion is an important objective for government. And in fact, we want to come up with a document sometime next year, because we've led the thing on sundry accounts, the financial sector charter, but does it go far enough? And how far can you go before the system is not safe? So these are hard questions that do require even more judgment. I think with regard to home host, shadow banking,
look, I'm very empathetic. I understand what you're saying, but it's very complex what happened in 2008, right? But I just think that, look, maybe this is the way it is. We can look at it more carefully. But it would be nice when next year, when you bring the bill, I remember we are several members of us here. And you're not speaking here, I'm not speaking here for my ideological skills, you know what I'm trying to say. There's something more systemic about the crisis that we're not facing. So what we're doing is we're looking at the ad hoc stuff. Like, what do we do to protect the consumer? What do we do to ensure that the banks are taking into account the financial risk? How can we monitor that more actively? How can we be more intrusive, right? So you've identified a series of challenges and you're addressing them. But what we don't have is like a framework within which you're doing it, like which will flow from a more structural, systemic understanding. The thing is, I'm not saying the stupid thing of, oh, okay, we can have it in the free market, let's all do it in our socialism. That's not the tradition I come from, maybe. But I think anybody, whether you're in the DA or, you know, let's say a more free market oriented party, you also want in this committee, presumably, a more systemic, structural explanation for what happened. Some of these things can't be resolved by law, right? I accept. But I just feel that what you said in some form or another is covered in the different things you read it, and the sort of thing the average MP in this committee would know. We're looking for something more. And I think it's unfair on you. We should look at the chapter. But if you come, is it nicer to have a clear understanding of what happened precisely? What can we do about it in the confines of, let's say, a social democracy? If you like, the MP would say we're a national democratic transition, that's where we are. But to make the parliament more acceptable in the parliamentary terrain, let's say you can understand the ANC to be, and the government to be, a mild social democracy. And what do mild social democracies do post 2008? But these are things that I don't have answers to, and I don't think you necessarily have to be a writer, because you are obviously the executive, and you will have a particular view, you've been working on this bill. Where is the research support for these questions? Right, so you should coordinate and see if we get answers to these things in 3 to 4 months. Also, the other thing I need to draw attention to, obviously, if you were here, we have read all of this. I mean, it's a hell of a lot, and I'm very grateful that you've given it, and don't just stop doing so. But here again, we need the research team to be on the ball. You have to summarize these things for us, we have to meet with you separately from the executive at times, so you brief us properly. Now, what's great at one level is the bill's only going to come to us in May. I think it's coming to us in January. In my program that I started working on to share with you and Dave, I've got, you know, hearings, prospective hearings on, so it's good you come out. I'll check that. What I'm saying is we've got more time, Bridget, and the team from PBO. I think we will have a content advisor from the 1st of January, and so on, the digital system. But you see, this is we are raising. We can't just bank on the negative. Parliament must come to its own independent views on this matter and engage with the executive. Because we see things always with a lot of advantages for it, but in a much different way. But I accept it, I don't think it's easy. I'm just saying that there is something more than what you are saying, presumably that even for the pursuit of this bill, we may need to get a better feel for it.
Yeah, but you know, underlying all, I just want, before I come to reverse through the answers, is I think the issue of the incentive structure in the financial sector, and you see me with banking, because you know the phrase that's made that you privatize the profits but you socialize the losses, because essentially it's what they call moral hazard. A major bank knows that they can take riskier loans and make more profits, and if things go bust, government is sort of, even if it's not in the law, it's under some obligation to intervene and bail them out, okay? And that's why in society, obviously, and you hate bailing such people out and socializing the losses, but the impact is on other institutions, financial institutions, on the economy, etc. So, and that's why I think, like, the way in the crisis, some of the article I read, banking is, in a sense, political, because it involves taxpayers. And that's why your prudential regulators have to be very strict and look at all the bad incentives. And if you look overseas, banks are not shy about overpaying themselves, okay? So essentially, I think it's the incentive structure you have to look at in the financial sector. How do you correct that? And some of the measures are there to try and reduce that. But maybe just deal quickly with the adverse or almost shadow banking, then I'll deal with on the losses questions, get it in coming to the market for that issue.
No, just briefly, Andrea, I think it would be a very short, interesting conversation to find out about how this indicates the position. I think, you know, there's a lot of work on at the moment how that is incentive structures for how systems, financial systems particularly, which also is a version of the capital system, lend themselves to bubbles and to periods of greed and to how actors in systems like that, particularly when you have high levels of inequality, which I think is a contributing factor. And there's been a lot of really interesting work on that, so it might be very interesting to have a workshop on that. So we have a more structure, I think. And I agree with you that many of our approaches deal with the symptoms of it. But I think that is the nature of financial regulation, is to have a sort of a symptomatic approach to dealing with issues. And one of the symptoms, the issue of capital and liquidity buffers. So one of the ways you deal with lending is that you require a bank to hold a certain amount of capital against the loan that it makes. So if it makes a risky loan, it has to hold higher capital. The idea being that that capital is sort of a rainy day fund for the bank in case something goes wrong. So Basel III introduced a substantial number of additional capital requirements to ensure that we have better levels of sort of rainy day funds. We didn't allow it, but many other jurisdictions allow banks to hold the amount of rainy day capital in AAA-rated corporate debt, for example. One day they woke up and discovered that those AAA stuff was actually not even worth the paper it was printed on. So the rainy day fund actually went up in smoke. We never allowed that. We had much stricter capital requirements, but nevertheless we were implementing higher capital requirements as we go forward. And then there will be a process of introducing something called total loss absorbing capital, which will even go further than that. Liquidity just refers to how much liquid assets a bank needs to be able to hold to ensure that it can meet its obligations in short space of time. We found banks were quite short of the amount of liquidity they had. They could just meet their obligations if you went to withdraw their money. But then the other component is leverage, which refers to the amount of borrowings that banks themselves undertook. So banks borrowed quite a lot themselves, which creates a huge sort of knock-on sort of problem. So that's that issue. On shadow banking, briefly, a shadow bank is someone that behaves like a bank, acts like a bank, and does everything like a bank, but doesn't necessarily have a banking license. That's not illegal, no.
Will be illegal.
Yes. So one of the forms we bring forward is to make that illegal, or to force them to have a bank license. So the Bank Act says you're a bank if you take deposits. But to operate to be a lender, for example, so to make loans, you don't necessarily have to take deposits anymore. You can raise the money overseas or wherever. So we have very many lenders who don't have banking licenses, and they're growing quite quickly, both domestically and internationally. And some of them are very well run. So there's actually some of them have come to us and asked us, can they not please be incorporated somehow into the banking framework? I don't mention any names, these are big home loan companies and stuff. But that's fine. I think we would like to move that way. But there are others that obviously skirt the law and essentially do lending type activities without having appropriate licenses, so they don't necessarily have as much regulation as the risk that they bring to the system. And that's an ongoing process of ensuring that we work very closely with the credit regulator, because the credit regulator only deals with how those people lend. It doesn't deal with how those people deal with the risks that they bring to the system. So that's something that we are engaged with. I think I've answered that question. So I think many of our institutions are regulated, are internationally based, and I think that's just the nature of increasing of globalization, is that you end up with financial institutions from overseas operating in your country. So you first have to think very carefully about how, to what extent you actually want to allow it. We're quite conservative, so we don't generally allow foreign institutions to operate here unless they are registered properly here and have bank licenses, etc. Subsidiaries, so they have those subsidiaries here. But nevertheless, these global financial institutions bring risks to South Africa, and what happens when they go bigger? How do we deal with that?
I think with regard to the other questions, yes, when you have the financial sector, as I said, at the moment we are regulating specific activity, banking, insurance, etc. The default will change in the bill to say anyone who moves in the financial sector has to be regulated. But maybe Kathy can deal with some of those market conditions in order to do that.
So, I'm going to touch on a number of the questions that have been raised. One of the lessons that did come out of the financial crisis was around regulatory fragmentation, that we've got different institutions performing very similar activities but regulated in different ways. And this goes to the same question what we're talking about on whether it's a money market fund versus a bank, for example. They're performing similar activities, yet are regulated in different ways, and the securitization is the same. On the conduct line, it's something similar, and different institutions being regulated in different ways, even though they're performing similar activities. And so a major opportunity here for Quintiq is to be developing a consistent prudential conduct stability framework that applies across the sector. The question around Quintiq, why to impeach, it's not necessarily about setting up new authorities in itself, it's about the opportunity to really have these common frameworks, why to impeach and not one peak, that deals with the policy tensions. Obviously, sometimes a prudential regulator must deal with issues in one way, a conduct regulator must deal with them in another way. This provides the opportunity to deal with both. In developing this common framework that is activity-based opposed to institutional-based, what that means is that you're capturing an entity irrespective of whether it's named as a bank or as an insurer or as a whatever it is. If you're taking third-party money and you're investing it somewhere, you're exactly the same as operating a collective investment team, and therefore you should have the same obligations and responsibilities towards your customers. The new framework provides for that. And so rather than naming property syndication, it names that activity. You are taking public money and you're investing it. And if you are performing that function, you are in effect acting as a financial institution and should be regulated as such.
Just on the, to close on a number of other issues that came up, some of them are hard questions, so let me answer them. With regard to the NGR, we are having discussions with the Department of Trade and Industry about how best to get the other regulators. So let's just forget the NGR. At the moment, we're going to have a system, and you want to know how long should a piece of string be. So on prudential, we only have one prudential regulator. So even the cooperative banks, the regulator will move to the south. Okay, so there'll only be one pure prudential regulator in the country. However, even they stopped, because the concept of twin peaks of prudential and market conduct will also apply to medical schemes. But we think they should stay out of the system, but they could use the same concepts. They need to see that medical schemes are healthy, and they need to make sure that customers are treated fairly, so they could learn from those concepts. That's why we include them in the Council of Financial Regulators, and you know, the broad advisory forums that we have around Twin Peaks. But there'll only be one prudential regulator, but not on medical schemes. Okay. However, once you get to market conduct, we've got many players in the space. You see NCR, you've got the Council of Debt Collectors, and it is a question that I think we have to grapple with. And if you look at the FSB peer review to answer, how best do you regulate and to what extent do you want consolidation? There are pros and cons, and it's something that we are talking. However, I think the real important issues is if you look at credit. I mean, the DDI has moved to get affordability criteria. You know, in a sense, for these things, perhaps we're glad it's late. Perhaps we should have done them earlier rather than doing it now. But, you know, there's always wisdom in that respect. But, you know, we've been saying payday lenders, are we being tough enough? We're not being tough enough. I've even made names here. If you read the UK papers and just either Google FCA or Walmart, and you see the actions that are taken. Look at New York State. They don't allow payday lending. Because payday lending is a series of short-term loans. You're desperate, you get it, you have it for 2 weeks, you pay massively high interest rates. But the point is they know you're going to come back and renew the loan, and then renew it. So it's effectively one long-term loan. And we're going to deal with retirement on indebtedness. Cabinet actually took quite a strong position on it. Last chamber as well. So the issues are we being tough enough on payday lenders? Why do we even allow them in before we know exactly the impact on society? You can take any lending, you can take motor car lending. I'm not sure why today we allow 7-year car loans plus the balloon payment. Okay. Those are just feeding like the type of consumption driven society that we have. And you know, before I think there was a limit of 4 or 5 years. So this, but it's also there because there's clashing objectives. The one wants to give as much credit to people as possible. So government is not innocent in this, I'm saying. We're pushing. Now you see people are getting over indebted. So we need to ask, are we not being too liberal in providing too much credit? And, you know, credit for productive reasons is good, or if you're going to buy a house. But credit for consumption, I think, do we not need to have some limits? I think it's a broader question we need to ask. And do we not curb the excessively high fees on desperate people that are charged or interested in that kind of situation? With regard to issues like the African bank, I think you asked, I think whenever there's a crisis, and I think, you know, like doctors, the Reserve Bank can't tell the world, no, they looked at African bank, they said 18 months before the crisis. But if you're a good doctor, it's confidential. The moment people know the doctor's there, they know that the institution's sick and people are going to run for their money. So a good regulator doesn't tell you what they're doing. And I think it's something that once they've sorted out the problem, we think it's quite important that we look back and get an independent assessment of why the problem happened. And I think, I would suspect, you may find many fingerprints, you know, that we wanted lots of credit to people. And so you have a bus there, you have perhaps on the prudential side. I mean, if you look at the FSB review, it says that we've got limitations of financial groups which the Twin Peaks world is going to attempt to deal with. It's how do you supervise a financial group, because a group does everything, banking, lending, insurance, retirement. Do the regulators even talk when they deal with a financial group, and who deals with the parent company? So there's hard questions to answer, and I think we shouldn't blame too easily, but I think we need to understand what the problems are. With regard to the Germany chair you mentioned, I would not hold the German model too highly, especially if I'm living in Spain or Portugal or France or Italy. They've got a common currency, and therefore huge problems. And of course, what we haven't talked about is Euler obviously didn't move to the logical conclusion of, if you have a monetary union, the question has been, you do need a fiscal, some sort of stronger fiscal union. And you know, I guess it's a case of, don't try and be half pregnant, because then you neither fish nor fowl, and what happens is people, we don't even know as a mayor what pregnancy means, so I, you know, but I'm just saying. Okay. So the issue here was that Europe did not go to the logical conclusion, and so whilst Germany had been booming, the other countries are really suffering, they're in recession, they're getting to deflation. There are huge issues, and I look at what happened in Iceland and how many Germans were involved in Iceland. So look at the system and you'll see that the regulations only looked in Germany when they should have been looking at the entire EU perhaps. And those are the reforms that you'll see. I think just on the issue of why so few comments, I think here, Olympics is not controversial in a sense of, you know, ordinary people in the street will support market conduct, okay, because it will protect them better. And it's complex, so people do find, like the tax laws, they find it hard to deal with. On the institutions, generally they've responded as associations, banking associations, short-term insurers, etc. So it so you get consolidated opinions. And the industry is used to being regulated, so they prefer coming out with one that will apply to the industry. So there's been pretty intensive discussions, but issues are extremely complex, so you shouldn't be surprised that you're not going to get hundreds of comments. Having said that, yes, we know it's a late period, that's why we will, at least, if we were to put out something in December, we'll say comments will be taken until the end of February. And remember, this is just to sort out the issues before we finalize the bill once again. And in fact, the bill will not change that significantly from its essential architecture from the first draft. I think this is about smaller sort of changes. There are some significant issues. And I would say, yeah, if we do succeed in publishing the bill this month or in January, it would be good not for formal hearings, but if we could come with a new bill in February, just one session, talk through it, so the publicity is out, and we can explain it in more detail. I think we've answered all the questions.
Thank you. It's so far it's an overview. There's never meant to be a fully exhaustive discussion. The signaling was what the main themes are. I think you've done that pretty well. Okay, it's the retirement reforms. I think members know that we have got a sitting now in the House on Thursday afternoon. Secondly, we have got a new bill, the Banking Amendment Bill. Have you got it? Yeah, can you send it to members? Has that bill been presented? Has that bill been tabled in Parliament? The Banking Amendment Bill?
No, it's been approved by Cabinet.
Yeah.
We're just talking to the relevant people here just to see if we can be tabled soon. So there's a few smaller issues.
That will be tabled in the next 2 weeks or so.
Yes.
All right, then we'll have hearings for that bill and the ILBA bill at the same time. The members might also want to think about this. As things have panned out now, tomorrow we've got sitting on adopting all the minutes from here and two outstanding reports, the ILBA and accounting standards board. Sorry, FSC. Now it occurs to me that that meeting's not going to last for more than an hour or so. And we might want to say that we process everything informally today, and then we can just vote on Thursday, 5 minutes before 2 o'clock or something, and get it done rather than sit tomorrow. But I'm here, it makes no difference to me. Members, just think about it before the meeting ends, just guide you whether you want to sit tomorrow or not.
I can talk through the problems in a moment, but yeah, I think on retirement reform, the big issue for us has been that this process is not new, but sometimes in the search for the perfect system, that you know, there's a lot of problems for members of retirement funds, and we'll just spell some of them out, whether it's the high charges, whether it's poor governance, whether it's the multiplicity of funds that you have. There's a number of problems, whether it's the duties that you take up when you retire and what the charges are there, etc. So that allows us just, you can start coming later.
Thanks, honorable members and chair. So just to kick off, I'll provide two slides just to give you a sense in terms of where the pressure points are in our retirement system, and take you through some of our thinking in terms of how best to address those challenges and the problems. So chair, just to kick off, sorry.
Some of those cover documents that we've published on Ken Polano and outline them over time. But I will guess the latest update of the 2014 budget, the update document that you have there. But can you just explain the documents even as you go so members know what documents you have?
Okay, so just to start with the first challenge we've identified in the system, Chair, deals with the level of preservation. So our study reflects that around 6% of current working adult Africans will manage to replace their incomes fully in retirement. And on average, the sense is that the replacement rates are sitting around 24%. So just to explain a bit what the replacement rate means. So a replacement rate deals with the income you will be earning in retirement in relation to the income you would have earned just before retirement. So just give a quick example. If you were earning 100 rands before retirement, and your income in retirement is 20 rands, your replacement rate will be 20%. So that's initially the essence of a replacement rate. Ideally, you want individuals to at least have a replacement rate of around 40%, and that's the ILO standard. But it's quite useful if Africans can actually be able to aim for a higher replacement rate, and that would arguably be around 80 to 100%. Again, depending on your circumstances when you reach retirement. Another important statistic that comes from Old Mutual, which shows that around 2013, at least 90% of workers who withdrew from funds cashed in their retirement savings. So the problem of preservation relates to individuals changing jobs and accessing their retirement savings prematurely. I think we will all agree that the principle around retirement savings is to literally preserve them until retirement, because that's essentially what retirement savings are about, and if you want to have an income in retirement. A second area relates to cost, and Momesh touched upon the issue around them, of course. So it doesn't help much to try and encourage South Africans to save if a significant portion of their returns is going to be taken up or eroded by costs. And our research used to indicate that regular fees, and this comes in the form of management fees, could literally erode up to 40% or at least 40% of returns on retirement savings. Linked to that, Chair, is the complexity of a number of products, for example, retirement annuities, which are not always understood by individuals. We receive quite a lot of complaints regarding RA. So people going on RA's thinking that when they hit some income or expenditure challenges in their life, they can always be able to tap into RA. And unfortunately, they realize that actually RA's are locked in. So just to go to governance issues, Chair, and I've got a slide just to indicate the significance of the pension industry in South Africa. In terms of assets, the industry has the fifth largest size, as a percentage of GDP. And the importance of that is that it places a huge burden and obligation on trustees in terms of how best they discharge their duties in relation to the funds and then the workers. So we have tried to deal with some of the governance issues, and I'll take you through some of the slides in detail to just give you a sense on some of the failings largely around the trustee and then how best we think they can be addressed. Lack of utilization, Chair, and this links to the Taxation Laws Amendment Act, the postponement which has been proposed. The economy to that is that the missed health can at times discourage people from saving and advertising. And largely because the missed health act is intended to do is to assess how much of income an individual receives, and then based on that, determine if you qualify for the social old age grant. And the anecdotal evidence we are getting out there is that people tend to be quite reluctant at times to save and to advertise because they think they are going to lose their old age grant. So we have proposed in last year's budget to phase out the interest, and we feel this will go a long way in encouraging South Africans to save and also advertise. And just the last point on that, Chair. The advertising problem is inherently a problem with provident funds, because as you be aware of the distinction between pension and provident funds. With pension funds, by law, you are required to at least advertise 2/3 of your benefits in retirement. Provident funds, there is such a requirement. Essentially, you can take your entire benefit as a cash lump sum. And that unfortunately can lead to other challenges. In particular, people tend to quickly spend their capital in retirement. Chair, there's a concern around coverage. So I think it's important to state up front that in terms of coverage, we have made good progress, and this is largely because of unions and employers who have taken it upon themselves to establish various funds, but it comes funds. And those have helped and gone a long way in terms of improving retirement coverage. However, Chair, there are some gaps in the system. So, for example, if you look at the agricultural, domestic, retail, construction, and small employers, you will realize that they are quite low participation rates. And hence, we have been trying to see how best to get those cohorts into some form of a retirement product. And there are a number of solutions. You could consider auto-enrollment, which is something the UK has recently rolled out. And the way auto-enrollment works, just to give an explanation, Chair, is that by default, everyone will be enrolled into a retirement fund. But the good thing about the default is that as a member, if you're not comfortable with the default, then you can opt out. And when you look at international research, it shows that by and large, individuals tend to remain with the default. So they hardly exercise the decision or the right to opt out of the system. So essentially, you end up with a much better outcome, not necessarily having to take a more paternalistic approach. The more paternalistic approach, Chair, will be more feminization system. So you just require everyone to be a member of pension fund and therefore prohibit any opting out. It's a much more stronger system. And both can actually work depending, of course, on the political economy of your country. And Chair, quickly on that point, I think we realize that when it comes to low-income individuals, we might need a different incentive system, because your low-income workers will already be out of the tax system or tax net, so they will not be paying any tax. So the question is then how you best incentivize them. And one way of doing that is probably to consider what we call a matching contribution. So as an example, the way it works is as follows. If a member contributes 1 rand, you would then contribute an additional 1 rand as government. And it can take form of a physical actual contribution or more of a commitment where you sort of contribute a notional 1 rand. Of course, there are implications for the fiscal, and that's an area we are still focusing on, Chair. Chair, there are too many funds in the system, and the challenge with that is that you start losing an economies of scale, and pensions are very much an economies of scale game. So the more members you have in the system, the more funds are in the system, and the longer they remain in the system, the better you are in terms of being able to spread the cost. And over time, you realize that the individual and the cost start coming down quite significantly. The challenge also with saving too many funds is that it's quite difficult to supervise. I've always given this example. If you look at the reserve bank, especially thinking about supervising arguably six large banks, vis-a-vis plus minus 2,500 pension funds. So we think it's quite critical if we are going to try and deal with some of the accidents which have happened in this space to see if we can consolidate the number of funds there. And in fact, it will also yield benefits to members. But as I argued, the more skills you have in the system, the better in terms of cost. Okay, another area which is receiving quite a lot of attention is on defaults. And we feel that one way of dealing with some of the challenges in the system is to see if we can have the right default in place. And this will relate to preservation, investment strategy, annuities. Just to give an example quickly. So when it comes to preservation, currently we are sitting with an unfortunate default. And the default is that if you resign, you automatically think the right thing to do is to access your money. And if it's the right thing for one to do is to preserve. So what we are trying to do with the default is to put in place a system which will default the individual's retirement savings into a preservation fund. However, that doesn't necessarily mean the money is locked. The individual, if they feel that they still need to access their retirement savings, and if they also receive financial advice, then they can be able to still access their money. So that's sort of opting out of the default.
This is quite an important concept, because when people, as you see, been resigning from their pension funds and so on, you know, this is their money, and so people don't like to feel that they are locked in. And of course, you want to educate people that the longer you commit to leaving your funds, the better your returns. Whereas if you want the power to take out any time, you are going to get low returns. But the whole issue of defaults is quite critical. Currently in our system, throughout our defaults are wrong. So what Alana was saying, you resign from your job, the HR department just takes your pension base account. Doesn't tell you, you could have put it into a preservation fund. Doesn't tell you you're going to be taxed if you take it out. So we as government can be very happy because we get more tax. But it's not good for the member. So, the default is based on behavioral theory, okay, which is quite a big area of economics. The simplest one for some of us of the male gender is, if you go to a loo in a urinal, they paint the fly there, okay. They find that when the fly that's painted, there's less mess around. Okay. And these are proven things. So that's not taking away anyone's right. But just suddenly you get people to behave properly or do the right thing in a sense for themselves. Okay. So this is quite a big area of economics now. That and a big area in the tax system certainly. That you want to have the right default. So we want to change a lot of our defaults in the system so that at all stages, if you do a certain thing, it always puts you in a default that you have. So auto-enrollment is another default. What happens is you start work. You don't get, unless you told them, put my money here, the money is deducted and put in some sort of retirement fund, which is relatively safe. You then have to sign a form to get it changed and maybe get financial advice. So, this is a big part in what Orlando said. So our approach is not to force, but preferably to have the right default and allow you to opt out if you want to opt out. But before you opt out, we say you must get some financial advice.
Thanks.
So chair, coming to the last area, and that's relation tax and basic simplicity. And chair, this is the principle which informed the recently postponement on the taxation laws amendment act regarding advertising and appropriate tax incentives. But we do strongly feel, chair, that when it comes to saving and the need to encourage individuals to save, it will help a lot if the products are quite easy and simple to understand, including also the taxation. So under the current system, you get different tax dispensation depending on what you are contributing into, whether it's an RA, a provident fund, or a pension fund. I think the key point there is that if you are contributing into a provident fund, as an employee, you would not be able to derive a tax benefit from your contribution. What the proposal, and actually now it's more than a proposal, what the amendment did was for the first time to afford or provide employees or members of provident funds to actually claim a tax deduction, same as with members of our pension funds. And we feel it's quite a useful incentive to have. And it starts simplifying the system. It starts treating all retirement products the same. And makes it easier for individuals to be able to calculate how much they need to contribute and what the implications are. So that in essence gives a summary of the slides which I'm going to follow, but I'll take you through some of the details. Chair, just to give an update and progress on the reforms themselves. So we brought in one of the largest pieces of legislation a year ago, the Financial Services Laws General Amendment Act, which effectively was amending various pieces of legislation. And one of those was the Pension Funds Act. And essentially, there we were trying to see how best we can deal with some of the governance challenges. So we made several amendments which gave effect to the following points. So firstly, providing protection to whistleblowers, who are board members. And another key amendment was to make it a statutory requirement that board members or trustees should attain skills and training within 6 months. And just to explain a little bit there, Chair, so this is not a pre-requirement, because we did receive feedback from the public that the moment you reach the pre-requirement, then it could unfortunately exclude certain workers from being members. However, even though you still need to ensure that there's some kind of a fit and properness test, we did feel that the best way of dealing with that concern is to make a requirement, more of a post requirement. So you can appoint whoever you deem as suitable, but ensure that within 6 months after their appointment, they undertake their sufficient training and skilling. Another area, Chair, we try to deal with, and this was coming more from the unions, is criminalizing the non-payment of pension contributions to a pension fund. We've seen a number of examples in the mining industry where employers were actually deducting contributions from employees, but the money was not being transferred or deposited into a retirement fund. Chair, we have provided for harm protection for board members trustees from joint and several liability. We have also made an amendment to the fact that no pension fund can commence the business of operating a fund without a prior registration, which was not that clear in the previous act. And we made it also clear, Chair, in terms of the fiduciary duty owed by trustees, to the extent that the trustees should always be aware that the duty is towards the fund and members. The previous provision only made some ambiguous reference to the duty being towards the fund, and we felt that that could have some shortcomings, and therefore it must be more explicit that the duty is actually supposed to be towards both the fund and the members. Then we also made some amendments to the Tradition Laws Amendment Act, and as you'll be aware, this was a provision which was still under consideration for postponement to 1 March 2016. Especially, as I indicated from the previous slide, the amendment was meant to simplify the situation of retirement contributions. We did propose various measures to protect investor rights, and I'll deal with some of those measures as we get to the actual slide. And actually, I'll go into some detail on that amendment here. Then, budget 2014, we also revised the tax-free lump sum available at the retirement from 350,000 to 500,000. And that's largely to try and alleviate the burden on your low-income individuals. Another important milestone was the release of the draft regulations on tax-free savings accounts. This was done on 14 November. And I'll touch upon the need for South Africans to try and save beyond just their retirement. Because the reality you see out there is that people then tend to treat their retirement savings as an all-encompassing, only saving cycle. And of course, because we all experience rainy days at some point in our life, we experience income shocks either because of retrenchment, etc. We are only left with one vehicle to assist us, and that tends to be our retirement savings. So the tax-free savings accounts here are meant to try and see if we can encourage South Africans to save beyond just their retirement savings. So just very quickly, so we released a number of pay cards in the last 2 years. So we had overview papers between 2012 to 2014, and these are the papers Momo had mentioned before. So the one paper dealt with strengthening retirement savings, and again, this was providing just an overview. We then released a follow-up in 2013 entitled Retirement Reform Proposals for Further Consultation. And that was followed up this year, Michelle, by another update overview paper titled Budget Update on Retirement Reforms. So there were a number of technical papers dealing with the various problem areas identified in the previous slide. And that dealt with having a better income. This one, Michelle, sure. Michelle, Sure, Chair. Chair, I'll go quickly through the slide on savings. Chair, all of this is motivated by trying to get South Africans to save and to improve our savings rate. So this one is just to give you a sense in terms of how basically South Africa is doing in terms of savings.
We have heard the exchange with them as the new year, so this is not the initial work.
Yes, Chair. So Chair, I'll go quickly through the slide. So just to give you an indication where we are sitting in terms of gross savings as a percentage of GDP. And I know the colors are not appearing on the hard copies, so I think this will just focus on the screen. So in terms of household savings, and that's where the problem is sitting, so that's the red line hovering around the 1.7%. Gross savings stood at 13.5% in 2013. Government has obviously not been doing particularly well, and the reason is quite simple, is because of the need to undertake other cyclical measures during an economic downturn. And I must emphasize that, in fact, the reason why as government we were also able to undertake those counter cyclical measures is because we were quite thrift in the years preceding the 2008 financial crisis. So it illustrates that saving is not necessarily only beneficial for households, but actually for government too. In terms of comparing with peers, you can see the red line there is China, gross savings of around 51%. As I indicated previously, South Africa is sitting at 13.5%. So I mentioned that South Africa has got the fifth largest pension assets internationally. So that's the
percentage of GDP.
So, Chair, based on the identified challenges and problems, we then came up with a set of proposals in terms of how best can we deal with those challenges. So this list, six of those proposals, first being to encourage preservation and portability, so that these two be able to move your retirement savings as you also move between employers instead of an internship. Enhancing governance, we've indicated how we have tried to deal with the governance issues, encouraging and retiring, and that's part of the about to be postponed taxation amendment act provision. Encouraging non-retirement saving, and for the last point I made on the last slide in terms of seeing how we can encourage South Africans to save beyond just their retirement. Simplifying the taxation of retirement contributions, that is part of the about to be postponed taxation of retirement act. And importantly, Chair, encouraging good value retirement products and services by reviewing the various costs in the system. Chair, these are the details, and we will chip in them appropriate, but I'll try and go through quickly because, as I said, the first two slides basically summarize the details. Chair, I've mentioned the problem in the current situation that individuals are not behaving sufficiently. We have proposed, Chair, that we could probably consider allowing individuals to maybe access up to 10% of their retirement savings annually, because I think we do realize that food preservation in South Africa is not going to work particularly well. But we also acknowledge that we do need some form of preservation, because the current initiatives are not working to anyone's advantage. We will, whatever law comes into effect, it will ensure that vested rights are protected, because you don't want legislation to apply in retrospect. So this could mean that the money would have accumulated right up to the date of new legislation, you could still be able to access it when you change jobs and the rules. So, for example, the 10% yield would apply to new contributions.
Let me just come in to explain. I think when I said our approach is to incentivize to have a default and to allow opting out. A lot of these things, when you say for retirement, you are getting a tax deduction. So it's a fact that if you want to enjoy the tax deduction, you must then preserve, you must annuitize some of it, not all of it. And like Olano said, you're not going for 100% preservation. And these are just proposals that we're putting forward. And a lot of these proposals are in discussion. Said we'll go to NASDAQ, etc. They're not the law. It does need broad consultation. But at some point, we do need to make decisions, because otherwise, people do make the wrong decisions all the time because the defaults are wrong. But I'm not even have to move much faster.
Chair, I'm going to skip this slide because
No, I wouldn't skip this slide. I think this is a big issue. Poor governance. Trustees with conflicts of interest.
Maybe, given that you have done this work and you've been seeing for this, that we give you a bit more time. And the questions will be few. I've got a 1 person appointment about 10 minutes from here. I can stay till 1:05. And if I just want to stay there, you all the time you can share, we can continue. I think I need to share because there's 10
points. Sure.
Yes. I don't think you sit under pressure, because I think we packed in too much money because we lost last Tuesday. And we still have a Davis tax commission. So how much time do you want for that? 5 minutes. Yeah, okay. Fine. All right. Over to you. I'll need to handle it yourself.
So, Chair, just on the governance, I really think that this is an area Parliament needs to focus on. There are lots of problems in this. And, of course, part of it is because when you've got too many trustees, there's too many conflicts, there's a misunderstanding of the role of trustees, the outcome from unions you've had, you know, whether it's business or unions, they bet so strongly for their particular interests. You read these stories all the time. But the first question to ask whenever you have a problem with any pension fund is, what are the trustees doing before they blame anybody else? Are they doing their jobs? Okay, and then there's very cushy relationships with the service providers. So there's a system of kickbacks that apply, that you have all your trustee meetings at fancy places all over, you get soccer tickets, you get this, you get that. All of those abuses must stop and be disclosed. And even on the companies when we go, I mean, we go to unions, we go to workshops in Mahabharata, it's paid for by the companies. Anything that money is coming from, it comes from pension fund members. Okay? So, and we want these institutions to also disclose every cent that they use to sponsor activities. So this is a big idea, and I think we need to move quite aggressively to fix up these problems.
Thanks, Mumbai. Just to add to that, I think Parliament has already helped us significantly, because a lot of the issues they were dealt with in the financial services, General Amendment Act, they asked for some areas which could still be attended. So thanks, Mumbai. Chair, for policy purposes, 3A and not deals with the currency annuitization at the time. And so this is the issue which has caused some concern in the public in terms of requiring provident funds to annuitize as part of the tax benefit that is dispensation, which Home has indicated that for the first time we would be providing a tax benefit to provident fund members. If it is only fair that we are going to provide such a tax benefit, at least to require provident fund members to also do the right thing in retirement, which is to take a portion of their benefit as an income or an annuity rather than a cash lump sum. I think we have tried to protect the enterprise as much as we could, and I will try to take you through that side quickly. And Chair, there's an area around how best to improve the annuity market, and this links also to the default. So currently, Chair, if you leave employment and go into retirement and you are a member of a pension fund, you are required to purchase an annuity if it's not provided in-house by your pension fund. And that annuity can take two forms. It could be what is called a life annuity or a living annuity. A life annuity would protect you against what we call longevity risk. So the risk that you could literally live long in retirement and actually outlive your retirement savings, because it's an insurance. Guaranteed to pay you until you die. But because it's an insurance product, it can be quite opaque at times and quite difficult to understand. And I think because you can't be able to purchase a life annuity upon death, that either way has discouraged certain members from opting for a life annuity. The other option is to go for a living annuity. It has its own challenges too, because then you take the market risk as a retiree, and there is that risk that you could draw down aggressively and therefore deplete your capital early in your retirement. And so the default would help in terms of funds having to identify and understand the cause within their pension fund and coming up with suitable annuity products default their members into them. And of course also if it's done by the fund, then you also get better bargaining power compared to an individual going out alone and trying to negotiate with the main financial institutions. A chance of simplified current policy priority for, and that deals with the temptation loss amendments and act. I think I'll probably go quickly.
Yeah, because this was prevented, yes,
sure. So, Chair, another important area is how best that we encourage South Africans to save beyond just their retirement savings.
Sure.
So, policy priority 6, Chair, that deals with the cost. Chair, I just state upfront that the charge fee on the right is not necessarily perfect, and the reason why it's not perfect. It's because it's quite difficult at times to be able to compare an apple for an apple internationally, because there are different systems, different products, and this is the best we could come up with. And just based on that, you could see how the most expensive RA in South Africa actually happens to be the most expensive retirement product internationally. And so as you go down, the reason why you see some of those countries with low or lower cost of tariff is because of the design of the system. So if there's a system which obliges, requires everyone to be a member, it's more for either an auto-enrollment or an entry system, therefore you're able to get economies of scale and are able to have a better preservation rate, that could start dealing with the structural challenges we currently face in South Africa. So as I said, we don't have an industry system, and you see a lot of leakages in the system because of people cashing in their retirement savings before retirement. So this is an area we are engaging with the industry on, say, in terms of how best can we provide good value retirement products to retirees. So I've touched upon those areas in terms of finding a solution to the structural problems in the city, and I think the issues around improving fund disclosures, something that we touched upon as part of the existing customers initiative. I think that would be it for retirement.
I think it's going to end on the, you know, the other side of the coin of saving is indebtedness. And in fact, we'll email to Alan just a statement that Cabinet looked at this matter last June and came out with a pretty strong statement because, our household indebtedness is measured at 74% of disposable income for households. And if you look at the numbers that are in arrears, it's if I remember, it's about, do you have a figure there in arrears? But it's a frightening figure of a couple of million households who have are technically in arrears. And I think we've seen abuse of emolument attachment orders, reckless lending, debt collection by legal firms who aren't regulated, and in fact, motor car loans actually falling relative to, mortgage loans falling relative to motor car and unsecured loans. So there's a number of problems, and we're working currently with the Department of Trade and Industry and Justice, as per the Cabinet decision, just to figure out ways in which we can reduce and firstly, prevent the problem in the future because it's too much loose-headed. Secondly, to deal with houses that are in, households that are indebted. The terrible situation in South Africa is almost like people who are indebted, it's worse than in the time of Charles Dickens when he used to write about it. Because unless you're you have something that will be a benefit to creditors, most low middle class income earners who are indebted actually have no hope of getting any insolvency or AGS. And the people who lend to them deliberately use emolument attachment orders. That's why we've tried to de-link these things, or as people call them, garnish orders. Okay? So the technical term is emolument attachment orders. This is a major issue which we want to come to the committee separately at some point, but there are steps that we can take to actually relieve, I think, some of the households in the position they found ourselves in last time. So, I mean, I won't deal with the specific issues, but that's just to say that some of the practices, particularly of legal firms which focus, you learn that, it seems to me, in the profession, the law societies don't ever take on people who abuse the system in this way. Why they ever were not regulated and got an exemption, I don't know. And in fact, if we look at Twin Peaks, one of say that any financial activity, if you are collecting, whether you're a legal firm or not, thou shalt be regulated. And I think on these issues, I mean, there's strong evidence to suggest that some of these practices, in fact, are quite fraudulent. And in fact, we've spoken to the criminal justice authorities to take action for some of these transgressions. So this is the other side of the coin, because you can't get people to say that they're highly indebted. I think it's an issue that we need to deal with. Chair, we're done.
Chair, I'm going to ask a question, so I'm going to recommend people's this is an issue that is closer to my heart. Actually, I want to start with an example. If you build a library for a community, and the community decide to vandalize the library because they are angry that a bus that was supposed to come at 11 o'clock came at 8 o'clock. First is their investment right. They paid some form of tax rates to the government. But if they argue that it's within their right, because it's their investment to vandalize a property that government must take care of at a stage where it's dilapidated or it's obsolete, do you think it's correct to say that? It's not. So there must be some mandatory engagement that forces people to understand that if even if you waste what is yours, you must be held responsible for that. So I would be nice about auto enrollment. I wish there was auto enrollment in South Africa. That's my wish. Because there are people who've never held a job, but when they speak about taxes, it's like they made a direct contribution to us and they made certain demands, and we don't hold them responsible. So the postponement of the television legislation is to give effect to consultation to those people who still don't understand what the government has to achieve. We need to do it in a very nice way. The way you do things, you know, sometimes, the way you do the thing is very nice. So you do it, you give them a cup of tea, and then you put them in a nice boardroom and you explain what you are trying to achieve. Because the burden on the fiscus at a later stage will be huge when people did not invest in that time. And will we be able to take it as and when it happens if we're not going to deal with it now? So it's not that it's an element, whether it's my money I saved for it. I need to be responsible. I need to save for the rainy days. And if we need to incentivize, incentive doesn't necessarily mean cash all the time, you know. There can be creative ways to show the people the benefit of investing in the time and now to set an incentive that if you do it, maybe you get a tax rebate or something that can entice people to, but also the education. Because there are those who are honestly looking for a right, we don't understand things. The same thing I asked about, sometimes we think that people doesn't pay tax because they don't want to. Sometimes it's sheer ignorance, a lack of understanding, and that ignorance is taking advantage of by people sell products and actually abuse. So this is where we should not shy away when we engage. And this is a matter that we as politicians always take advantage of wanting to politicize. It's not a political issue. It's a purely financial management issue where as a nation we take care. I do not want my children to take care of me when I'm old and I stay in their house. Really? When I could have had a toilet when I was still younger. Plan for that. And I can tell you a point. You see, it's unfortunate that the Minister of Home Settlements, when she wanted to engage on the issue of housing, she put it in the way she did and people take care to task for it. The point she was making is that, really, after 20 years of democracy, you still think that a 40-year-old should get subsidy? But we need to integrate all issues, because there's an issue of education, there's an issue of skill development, basic giving access to jobs and blah, 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 that we need to address and make sure that the type of investment in the long run. So it's not a matter of actually to put it. We need to engage, just engage, show, it's not just back on the sport. Sometimes we really try very hard to make sure that there's a turning point on the sport. Because it's very impactful, it's going to be beneficial into those who are ignorant by facts now. It's going to have benefit. So we work very hard to make sure that we understand it. So if they don't want to feel, they just take them home. That's okay. Let them take it now and eat it all, and then take them home and come back to the Islam. That's okay. Thank you. I'm so sorry.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks very much for the update. It's very interesting, as always. How can I ask a lot of questions, because I know we operate for time and I'm sure we are going to engage more over time, so I will hold back. There's just one thing, or several things, but I'm going to point out the one thing that's really on the top of my mind here, is that this reform's been on the table for a very long time. It's been over a decade now, you know, and we're still not done with it. So obviously the process needs to end at some point. I would agree that it's necessary that we assist people to save as much as possible, because they are going to get older and we would want to look after themselves if possible. I'm just thinking about the asset management of the funds. Now, a while ago there was discussion regarding the asset management establishment of a national fund and etc. Now, obviously when people invest their money, they want to make sure that it's going to return good returns and that they have choices. Obviously not individual choice, which I don't support, and that they would have choice as to where their assets are invested. So I want to know if there's any discussion going on around the asset management of retirement funds. And I'll hold back on all the other things I'll raise them when we meet again. Thank you.
And I have quite a few questions too, but obviously you have just too peripheral treatment of the issue, given its importance. But obviously, you know, given the high unemployment rate, the levels of poverty and inequality, and the prospects of growth being what they are, at least by your own take, it's been very difficult to get consensus on this issue. And it's understandable that people are not going to budge. They can't simply want their money. So I think, you know, we need to find a sort of balance between giving people the right of ownership of their savings and at the same time acting in their interest. I mean, it's not peculiar to this area. For example, we have rules on trust, for example. Now people might want to take trust and fix my life, but if you're part of the society and you can escape, then responsibility of the sovereign state is to also act against your own subjective use in your own interest. Sort of thing I can't really say. But we need to have balance in India. I don't know how we're going to get it done. I see a big obstacle unless you win over people in India. But the broad thrust of what you're saying is eminently sensible, what I can see. I don't understand personally many of the issues. From what I can see at this stage, my tentative view is that what you're doing is good.
Thanks for that. And I think, you know, when Uncle George says this has been going on deeply, and that's why we've tried to even persuade of, for example, the Labour constituency, that a lot of these things are good, and to the extent that they piecemeal, so what? Because if you wait for this break in the environment of social security reform, the only people who will benefit are those who are imposing higher charges. It will be to the detriment of individuals. And so these are concrete reforms which even under the current system, you can improve significantly the growth and so on pension funds, on retirement funds. Secondly, that to the extent that you know, you do have to talk to a lot of people. I don't know if a lot of them mentioned it, but we had over 50 meetings, for example, with unions over these years, big workshops to go to in Mahalishwar. I say, why do you have a sponsor? But we talk. We've been doing a lot of talking. And we've had a lot of support, I mean, from shop stewards and so on, when they talk. And they do care about their money. They do, in fact, for starters, they don't want government to cash their funds. And you know, and that's why you've got to have a system where they feel they have control of their funds, but yet the system's designed so that they get the maximum amount of growth. So when Uncle George, for example, has talked about asset managers, and there's big debate out there that for many of these funds, the charges are also relatively high, and sometimes passive investments over a long period will give you, you know, nobody's going to beat the market consistently for 10, 20, 30 years. So do they really add value? And is it worth paying for that promise? But, you know, we don't want to make those decisions. We are just introducing defaults. But to leave it to the trustees then to say, no, we have faith, we want to do this, and we are talking to the CISA and the industry as well. Some things we agree, some things we disagree. But some of the reforms we've started, like if you look at consolidation, you can talk about ultimately you want one big national savings fund, but you know, that might be a big reform. I suggest those, lots of trustees will oppose that kind of reform. That's a big reform if you want. But, you know, to move towards 300 consolidated funds is a step in that direction. I mean, there's too many umbrella funds where members don't have much power to change things. Can we consolidate some of those? If you look at the South African retirement system, actually the employed sector is well covered, the formal economy. Our coverage is relatively high. Could even be amongst the highest groups, right, for any voluntary system that you have. The problem, of course, is in the informal economy. So if you have auto-enrollment, how will it work there? So, Chef, if you're talking to with the labor constituencies, vulnerable workers, with machines, people who work in construction or in and out of employment, how do you deal with their issues? So those are the types of hard challenges you need to face. But so to get back to your question on Mutbaas, the thing is too that there's a mix between yes, people must be responsible, but how can we nudge them in that direction? So our default is a nudging approach as a literature will really utilize. And you need to mix it with incentives, with education, and also get away from greed so people don't make stupid decisions, but people must take responsibility to when they make bad decisions. But, you know, watch the balance is the issue. I think, you see, even something like disclosure, when you have disclosure, I mean, in fact, I suspect a lot of these resignations, even from the GPM, are there because suddenly GPS started showing people their benefit shaker. People get a shock and see how much money they have. So, you know, you want disclosure, but do you want too much disclosure? And if you put disclosure, you should at least say, if you take out the money now, you will be debt so much you actually lose. But if you keep it, it will actually grow much more. You know, so even the disclosure statements the way you have, you should qualify and show people exactly how it works. Yes, make it more accessible for people to get info, but information by itself can also be dangerous because people do the wrong things. And not that you want to force them to do the right things, but can you prompt them? Can you nudge them? Do you at least think, do I really want to cash out this money? In fact, what am I going to do with this money? Go for financial advice. Can you, just a small delays of 7 days, often you find that gets people thinking and in fact they never get to do it and it actually stays for a long time.
With regards to the GPF, it's very interesting how the fund grew and managed about 1.6 trillion rand, certainly one of the biggest funds in Africa. And then, of course, there was a lot of publicity to the fund, as you mentioned, but the money is used with regards to the investment strategy of the fund, which to a certain extent, which is publicized in newspapers and in the press, was the political connectedness in terms of these investment strategies. That caused a lot of concern, I believe, for people to withdraw their money. But certainly, there's also the issue of the contingency reserve within the fund. And I was hoping that in terms of regulation, that we can get some clarity with regards to what the contingency reserve should be. Some of commentary, some of the people that have addressed in the past is simply a bookkeeping arrangement, but I think it's significantly important that we get more clarity with regards to the contingency reserve of the funds and what can be held. And then just the last remark in terms of savings and the importance of the currency, sir. You know, we have an unemployment rate of, say, in the broader definition, 36%, and we expect the broader public to save, which is, it shows its challenges in saving. And then we appreciate the tax incentives in terms of the savings. But certainly when people look towards an income, they pay the income tax, and when they at least save something, they pay tax again. Is it not a certain extent, a little bit of a double taxation, and could we perhaps make it more lenient in future with regards to this? Thank you.
I'll be a few questions, but can you reply quickly? Also, one minute answer. In fact, I'll cut you off in 25 seconds. The broader social security reform, where is that? Has it been abandoned and so on?
Okay. I think Honorable Ross's questions are hard, and to the extent that they apply firstly to GVF. I'm saying when it's issues of GVF, for example, that doesn't fall under the Pensions Fund Act. In fact, one of the things we want to do is to have a uniform approach, even with regard to state pension funds, so they extend that they have their own legislation. Secondly, I think on the other issues, we are engaging, and I think, you know, it's, even if we give a written response, I think these are a lot of challenges that we face. I don't think we can just answer them. There's a lot of issues around funds that you have, how they communicate, what do they do with services, etc., etc. But you know, all of these are in that fund, and it's a role of trustees that you need to look at, and when does the state come in. I think your question on social security reform, there's a paper that's on dealing with some aspects of social security reform, which government has had a committee that's been working on this issue, and the paper has shipped for cabinet. Cabinet was still engaging with it. We are looking at a process of getting, there's been quite a lot of work done, getting the papers out. But these are complex issues, so they don't reach the resolution that people expect. You're just going to have a paper that's going to solve all problems. I think Uncle Ross's point is, in a situation where there's very high unemployment, all these things become very difficult. So even the issue of trying to get rid of the means test, the social class, is something we wish for. But under the current circumstances, it's not possible. So, yeah.
Let me ask this, because people are going to come here and say they're not happy with these concrete ad hoc amendments, where's the problem? Yeah. That's all. So that's the issue we have to deal with. Okay, thanks. And the Insights Commission?
Actually, didn't have anything to say on it, to be honest. But it's been on the committee. I thought how the matter was dealt with. And I think, to be fair, if you want a report from the committee, you have to ask the judge himself to come. I won't name him. I think we all know his judge, okay. Of course, they've produced some of their papers, like on small business taxation, and they've had comments, and so we didn't proceed. And the judge has promised that two further papers will come out, he said, end of this month. So, and I expect, given their task, like say they work in the mining tents and so on, some of these are going to take much longer. And so I think you are looking at the process of perhaps 2 years when all these papers are done. So I don't know what update was required, but I think
even though it's to do with India, so we raised this matter, this was part of the issues put on the agenda. We asked if Professor Bennett himself would come here. He was suggested to us that he would come with you, and we changed it because you we had to do various other things. Now, in our program, this is the only remaining issue. As I remember, there's nothing that we said we would do that we haven't done, right? Everything's been done. But we don't do things nominally. We can't just say, okay, like a tick box thing. Yeah. So, on the Business Tax Commission, people across the parties wanted some submission. You referred us to the website. We said, no, you and Professor Davis appear. Finally, it was decided that you would speak. This is discussions with your parliamentary. So ask them about why it is that we are where we are. We understood that you would be ready to make a submission, we give a date and it's put back. And so I said, sure, let's not get into that distribution. We've done exactly what we said we would do. We're perfectly reasonable what we did. We did not deliver now because you're saying that those reports are not fully processed, that none of that which is processed, we have it in some other way dealt with. Is that answer?
Change. They produced some papers, and I would say that on those papers, I think it would be good if the committee were to call the committee to do.
You're not meant to handle it.
The other papers are still that they finalized.
Oh,
so it's a bit premature to comment on. I mean, we haven't seen the papers they're coming out with. Once you come out with those papers, obviously you can come out.
Let's take the matter like this. We will engage with your parliamentary liaisons and yourselves and find out how we take this matter forward. Right, and it wants at least to give us clear, precise, concise answers to our questions, how we process it, so I hear it goes, and we have this on the agenda. So what we will do is then, if you're saying you don't have to be here, you're saying we can have the commission here without you being present. We were told that you have to be present.
Yeah, we don't if you want us to be here, there is a paper we can give a departmental response. If a lot of these we think it's good to put out to the public, let's get discussion. Or obviously, and I just wanted to correct you on one thing, which is it's not a commission, it's a committee.
Right.
And obviously they make what their status is one of an advisor.
That's right.
One,
so we are not all that.
Yeah.
Okay, so in that case, we will identify, can PBO and yourself help us, which aspects of the Davis Act Committee we want. We were going to give it, we were wanting an overview initially. So why don't we look at the sections that are possibly relevant to the budget 2015. So we'll engage with you around that, and we'll do it in the first tranche of meetings in the January. That's done. Okay, thank you. Now we've got two reports that have been distributed to members. I just want to draw your attention to the, you can leave if you want. Let's look at the one on the Financial Services Board, right? Yeah, I think they can distribute it. If you turn to, we're not going to vote on it right now, we're just drawing attention to the recommendations. Right, we just hold us here in the first draft, you had recommendations, they're falling on section 6. So the word recommendations is missed out. Okay, so firstly on the 6.1. Essentially, it's a shame that issue that David constantly raises on each today. And they explain to us why they are where they are. If you could look at that and others and come back to us, what I'm suggesting is that we decide whether we want to meet tomorrow or meet on Thursday. If they're going to meet on Thursday, then I would suggest by noon tomorrow, people propose the amendments they want in track with the 6.1 and any other paragraph that they want to. So in short, either meet tomorrow or we allow members to come in to track it and meet on Thursday just to vote. So let's start with that. What we had in mind tomorrow was rounding up, so dealing with the report and dealing with the minutes of the meeting. I think, can we minute this? Minutes are going to deal with this. The minutes should be submitted once a month. This is the rule of the committee, really. On the last Wednesday of every month, we need the minutes. So we adopt it month by month. Instead of doing it at the end of each quarter, let's just make that a rule. Because now we are stuck with minutes going back to 1920 or something, right? So that's the one thing. So all we have is to adopt the minutes, which is really a nominal process. And we have two outstanding reports. And we were able to review the year and look at the element of program for next year. But we are in fact going to have a strategy meeting in the first 4 or 5 days, so we can review this year and see how we can improve. So let's start with the practical issue. Do we want to meet tomorrow, which is for about an hour, hour and a half at the most, or do we want to process issues through emails and whatever, and then on Thursday, presumably half an hour or so before the sitting, once that you can meet in G26 to vote on, and we'll also have more members here on Thursday, obviously, because we're sitting, vote on these two reports and on the minutes. That's all that's said. What do members feel? Nobody's got any views? Sorry, let me. Yeah, sorry. It's true. Yes, it's in line for us. Yeah, but your focus is around one, I understand that. Well, we can meet after the sitting or during the sitting. We only need about half an hour. Otherwise, we can meet tomorrow. I'm coming here tomorrow because there's no difference to me. I'm only 1 minute away from it. I'll walk from my office to here. Okay, so we're meeting tomorrow. Right. Oh. He says that he can't make tomorrow. He's going to leave the job because he's got a personal matter. What do you do about tomorrow?
I'm available. 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 I'm
Can you organize some little snacks and things so we can have the lunch then? But at the time, most of us are available. Oh, you can sort that out, okay? We'll sort it out. Fine, no problem. We'll talk about that at this meeting. Can I read something then? In that case, it makes it very simple. Do we even need to go through this report, or shall I leave it to you to look at it and send to Ellen by noon tomorrow your email comment? I've looked at it, obviously. And there's nothing controversial. The only thing that upset me, as I said earlier, is that this thing of aid has done, Ellen. The ASB wrote to us. They made five proposals or whatever. We must put that in. Can we do that for afternoon, Bridget? Can you all consult each other before submitting the first draft to me, right? Because I went through the whole painstaking process summarizing. You wanted this, this is our response. You wanted this, because a lot of blabber. In fact, a lot of it is blabber, to be quite frank. The real thing about what did the committee say precisely, concisely, clearly? What did they ask of us? That's what matters really. At the end of the day, what did we say we are going to do? How are we going to proceed forward? The rest of it is really, what is that? So, unless you give us 81284, clearly, you've got the letter they sent us. Our reply, we'll get your minutes, you took the notes, I think there was starting with it. Can we do that, please, please? Okay. Otherwise, it report's quite good, in my view. Let's not understand. I have very few errors and so on. A few glitches here and there, which I sent you by tracking, and you separated them. Alright. The reason why it's not like desperately desperate, because there is no way you can table this report this year. Now, there's one more thing that's worrying PDO. I need to draw your attention. The only thing we didn't do, and this is not our fault, we put it on the agenda, but unfortunately, Advocate Jenkins, who's got too much of his plate, had to be at another committee at the same time, is amendments to the Money Bills Act. Right? Now, you can convince PDO you want to make a briefing. But really, what would be the value? We can't proceed. It can only be attended to next year. So, my friends, you are from the PDO, right? My father? So we convey that. I'll speak to Jared. I'm meeting tomorrow in any case. Also to report to you very quickly, because we still have 4.5 minutes. I have listened to PBO in regard to the mining joint meeting here last week with the Minerals Committee. They have been requested to begin work on bench, right? It's called base erosion and profit sharing. They've agreed to start that process. Then I wrote to them about, I wrote to Dupont, the chair of SOE, for the Public Enterprise Committee. They have approved and they've admitted some stuff to the committee to meet the progress to Mr. Professor Jai. So they're starting on the project of looking at best runs. Then the third thing they will ask them to work on is the area of they themselves in the MTDPS hearings, Professor Jai then said that look, be careful about this thing of public sector wage bill. Sometimes it destimulates the economy in other circumstances where a country's been in difficulties, weak growth, pending, they haven't reduced the public sector wage bill, so in our case, some sort of demand, right? So we said, do the work. So he's been requested, the PBO has been requested to do that work. As far as I know, you've done the thing of the tasks we agreed we would do. So each time we say, we want a 40 report, so what? We have to consider the report. It's only asking for a report. Give us a report. Love saying that. Give us a report. Right? Give us a report means apply your mind to the report and then make other proposals. So I think members, in our strategy meeting, we have to think we have to have more time in strategy meetings. We cannot proceed with our program. You've done the thing. Also, if you look at the bills that are already before us, coming in from nowhere, right? Our program next year is going to be far more intensive than currently is the case. So I just want to alert you about that. But we will be meeting, I think, on the 23rd. Is that right? 23rd of January. That third week, the third Tuesday, we'll be having public hearings on the two bills before us. Right. And then the following Tuesday, we'll have the strategy meeting for the whole day, where the department will come and tell us what they mean to do for the year, and we then shape our program, partly in response to the partly on things we should be put on the program for the year. Okay? So, the Money Bills Act. We have had some informal discussions, and I'll alert members. If some of us can win our way, we want to simplify this process, because we think it's utterly absurd that we have the finance and fiscal fiscal framework, then we have debates. Then we have the appropriations people dealing with the revenue, and the adjustment appropriations, then you have a debate. Then we come back and say exactly the same thing in a third debate. So either we have one debate, or we have at the end, or we will drop the system of repeating the same things. This is nothing new. It's not like the mind of the parliament is hard, which is not to say anybody is running away from debate. We are very happy to have debate. In fact, this party is clear about that. And I'm sure other parties will have it. But it's not like repeating the same thing. So when I checked with authority, there is nothing in the Money Bill Act that describes this. This is really something that can deal with by Parliament's programming structures and if they say the Rules Committee. I've raised the rules, I will be raising the Rules Committee meeting that we'll have early in the new year. But we need to look at that act for other reasons. Now the second issue that arises, which this committee has raised in the Parliament, we know it's ad hoc in changing the Money Bill Act. We have to prepare. Is this thing about the deadlines? You see, if you look at the cycle of the budget that the executive has, and the cycle we have in Parliament, they are not co-terminous. By the time we do our BRRRs, and by the time it's tabled and so on, the cycle for the budget is gone. So for 2015, the issue that we raised in the 2014 BRRR, actually, strictly speaking, we got addressed in 2016. Some of us have, for other reasons, before 2009, I think I said, asked if annual reports can be submitted before the end of August rather than before the end of September. So as to facilitate effective treatments of annual reports and processing with support. So I don't think PBO should just come here with ad hoc proposals. We need some discussion and we need to process it through structures. So I think really that's another reason why one is cautious about just teaching this proposed amendment to the Money Bill Act without looking. Of course, the GA has got its own reasons for wanting the whole act to be reviewed, which is their right to present what they're raising it. But listening to them personally, I'm not convinced for what they say, but it's for the committee to decide and for Parliament to ultimately decide. So, for a variety of reasons, on this matter of the Money Bill Act, we have to look at it holistically, is what I'm suggesting. So, in short, all of these issues will be put on the agenda for the strategy meeting. I'm throwing them out now for your consideration to mull them all over, and we will look at them in the strategy meeting on the last Tuesday of January. But just think about that. We have hardly put a position on this thing to the extent we can so that we can process them effectively. I hope you, my friends, you are listening to what I'm saying, and you're conveyed to Professor Jaya. Sorry? I don't know if you're because he's a replacement for... Brandon. Okay. Right. Having said that, is there anything else you want to raise about the next 48 hours or so, particularly? No. And third Tuesday of the month. The program will be sent to you, the draft program will be sent to you in about 10 days' time or so. I'm more or less done with it today. I'll have it and then look at it in the day, particularly the minutes here. Okay. Anything else? No? Thank you. Bye.